everybody. It was a 3-day weekend, and so we have 50% more insanity for you. Get ready for that.
What kind of math is that?
Well, we normally have X amount of insanity.
Okay.
We have 50% more.
Okay.
And in America, that's horrifying. Anyway, I'm Johnny Derulo. She is the cynical one. Brooke, no, she didn't believe that could be done, that we could fit in that much craziness. Hey, Brett. But anyway, we normally have you. Yeah, he's right over there. Oh. So we normally have you on Mondays. We didn't have a Monday show, but we wanted to make sure that the audience got their fill of you. Mm-hmm. And so we always say that we want you guys to rate and review the podcast. I know many of you are watching this live, but we also do this as a podcast. Mm-hmm. And one of the comments left for you is very positive. So we're going to read that
at the end
of the show. No, you have to wait.
Okay.
First your vegetables before dessert. And we've got a lot for you. A mixture of vegetables and dessert. You know, you just combine all the courses into one thing. But we're gonna be talking about a lot of stuff. Multiple instances of the media's outright failure to have adapted to the Donald Trump era of politics. We're gonna be starting off with that in just a little bit. Later on the show, we're gonna be joined by a state senator from New York who's got a really interesting social media privacy bill that he's pushing. We've got a crazy instance of police brutality with body cam footage making clear what this interaction was all about. Brooke's gonna be leading through us through that a little bit later on. Donald Trump teams up with a dictator against Joe Biden. And we'll also be joined by Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland to break down some of the news of the day a little bit later on. So big packed show, why don't we jump in?
Let's get to it, I'm ready.
Okay, I'm ready too. So, it's been a couple of years that we've had Donald Trump now, and you would think that the media would have learned something from this experience of 2 years of him campaigning, 2 years of him being president. But some of the most respected and longstanding sort of bastions of American journalism still don't seem to have really learned much. And I want to show you a couple examples of articles that I read over the weekend that drove me batty. So first, remember Hope Hicks? Hope Hicks was close advisor to Donald Trump, apparently somewhat of a friend to Donald Trump, as much as a sociopath can have an authentic friend experience. And so she's actually been asked by Congress to come in. She's been subpoenaed by Congress to testify about the experiences that she's had with Donald Trump, because of course in the Mueller report, she is referenced several times. And take a look at how New York Times Politics pitched the experience she's having. Hope Hicks, one of the best known but least visible former members of President Trump's White House staff, is facing an existential question, whether to comply with a congressional subpoena. And then you see that photo of her looking down. Now, in their defense, that's what 50% of all photos of women on Instagram look like. They're like looking down sort of shyly to the side. But she has been subpoenaed by Congress to tell, you know, what her experiences with Donald Trump were. And they're pitching it as, should she take, you know, a soul expanding journey to India to find herself? That's not an existential question, whether to comply with a congressional subpoena. But look at the cover, look at the lengths that the New York Times will go to make it seem as if she's just facing one of those sort of midlife crises, mm-hmm. you know, that people have, including a glossy sort of headshot style photography. Is this how normally when people are questioning whether they should comply with the law or not that the media pitches it?
Not if they look like me.
Uh-huh. Well, you've had some great headshots taken recently too.
I'm sure if I was contemplating breaking the law, mm-hmm. they would find some hideous driver's license photo that looked like a mugshot. Mm-hmm. But no, this is ridiculous. And I think also the focus should be on the fact. And a subpoena, it's a subpoena on purpose because it forces someone to appear. It makes it the law.
Yeah.
So essentially, she is contemplating breaking the law. Mm-hmm. But that's not what this looks like. She doesn't have a decision. You don't have a decision on whether or not to break the law.
Yeah.
It's not, you're supposed to follow the law. Mm-hmm. If you choose not to, that's a problem. It's not, you know, picking, you know, what color hair you want today.
Exactly.
I don't know, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and so let's just read just a little excerpt from the article. Her dilemma now is how to respond to House Democrats who have grown frustrated and increasingly aggressive in the face of a sweeping decision by the Trump administration and the Trump organization to oppose such subpoenas. Again, that framing there is mm-hmm. that it is a choice that they can make whether they will oppose or go along with subpoenas. Now, they've provided a little bit of context there. They've made clear that Hope Hicks is not the first person in the Trump administration or the Trump organization that is considering not complying with the law. But I would say that if you want this same sort of framing, if, I don't know, maybe it's supposed to appeal to people like me who are undergoing some sort of midlife crisis. They just want to use the word existential. How about this? America faces an existential question, whether a democracy can survive when one of the branches of government decide that the law doesn't apply to them. That, I think, is both a more accurate headline and really gets to the heart of the matter. Whether Hope Hicks will be able to slide by on some combination of the privilege that she has as a white person, as a highly placed, politically connected person, that's not an interesting question. We're seeing that every day. It's the New York Times' job to go deeper than that. And they have barely scratched the surface on a significant constitutional crisis that is unfolding every day.
Right.
And this is not the only example of it. So I don't want to just attack the New York Times. Let's make time for the Washington Post as well, or the very least the Washington Post magazine, who had this tweet from the magazine: George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying in Russiagate. Now he has a sexy new life in Hollywood. That is literally, that's what they wrote. That's not like the version of it that BuzzFeed aggregates or the sort of mocking version that Breitbart would have of it. That was their tweet. And that photo, no, hold on, we gotta go back to that photo, because look at that photo. They did a photo shoot, and by the way, the article is filled with them. Don't check it, because I don't want them to get any traffic on this, but him making kissy face berobed photos, the article is full of those. So, Hope Hicks at least has evaded any sort of legal consequences for what she did. She's just sort of enmeshed in it. And by the way, chose to be enmeshed in it and chose to continue in a fundamentally immoral administration. George Papadopoulos has already been found guilty of lying. And the Washington Post magazine believes-
He went to jail.
Exactly, for a limited amount of time, but yes. Right. The Washington Post magazine feels that it's their job to rehabilitate him. So New York Times, Washington Post, it's a two shot of these people who decided to be a part of an immoral and criminal administration. It's our job to make them look glossy and pretty and to give them makeup and fancy clothes. And to whatever extent that George Papadopoulos has a sexy new life, which nobody cares about and probably isn't true, this is the sexy new life. If you have a sexy life in Hollywood, it's because organizations like the Washington Post decide to use their resources and their time to take photos of you and to do these little spreads about you. I don't have a sexy life in Hollywood because the Washington Post has not given me one yet.
He doesn't
but
have
look
a
who
sexy
they decide
life
to.
In Hollywood.
He's wearing a robe.
Talk to someone logical.
He's wearing a robe and sunglasses. That's never been necessary before.
No, but you know, I am stuck on the word sexy because that is an opinion. It's not an opinion that this writer shares with me, but it's an opinion. And I find that fascinating because I think the Washington Post still, as much as they fact check, they still struggle sometimes with calling racism racism in headlines, calling Trump a liar in headlines, because they have decided that some things are opinions or some people, but calling George Papadopoulos sexy is an opinion. It's not even an opinion that you, I imagine, one shares with a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And so how does that slip through? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it slips through because I don't know. They want access to the administration. They want to make sure that other people that leave it decide to talk to them. I don't know. But I do know that they're making a choice here. And they have decided that they will be just another version of the Ben Shapiro's and the Dave Rubens, where their job is to whitewash horrible people's past actions and choices.
Right.
And that's what they'll do. They could have given this spread to literally anyone. There's all sorts of people. We're going to be talking about people later in the show.
They've
been victimized.
By the
police, by Border Patrol, all those things. You could give them a sexy new life and put them in robes and put them against a white background if you wanted to, but you chose not to. You chose to do that for Hope Hicks and George Papadopoulos, people who, to whatever extent they've had an influence on the country, it has been in a negative direction. And entering into an election, that's a scary thing to see the media once again getting into.
I honestly just want to know the readership on this before people started complaining about how ridiculous the decision was, because I have no care in the, and I like messy stuff. Like, I will read anything written about George and Kellyanne Conway and what goes on in that house. Any and everything, I will read it.
Do they have a
but
sexy
this,
life?
I have, do they even speak? You know what I mean? I don't know.
I don't even know who that other person is,
but
and I don't want to.
It's
unnecessary.
No desire. Yeah.
Hopefully few people clicked on it.
Yeah.
I apologize. Hopefully you watched this video so that you wouldn't have to read it.
Right.
Anyway, let's move to one other area. More failures in the media, this time having to do with the multi-state attack against Roe v. Wade that the Republican Party throughout the South is instituting. So this was the AP, by the way. Overturning Roe v. Wade wouldn't turn back the clock to 1973. So this entire article is about how, well, yes, there is a challenge against Roe v. Wade. These bills are designed to work their way up to the Supreme Court. The idea is that they think it can be overturned, but would it really be that bad? It wouldn't be like going back to 1973, would it? And it's not even that that's 100% wrong.
Right.
We have moved on in some other ways, But that's your framing, that's your focus amidst all of these assaults and the women who could end up in prison for the rest of your lives. This is what the AP is choosing to put out there.
Like, there are a lot of facts, a lot of things that are fact, but it matters how you tell a story and what aspects of a story that you choose to tell. And telling this side of a story, highlighting that, it does minimize that we're talking about the loss of reproductive rights.
Yeah.
It minimizes that. It's like, oh, there are choices and there will still be choices. It's, this reminds me of, and we talked about this before, there was a story in Atlanta where two prostitutes were murdered. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest local news outlets, I think ever, chose to go with an angle of people in the area being upset about prostitution.
About the continuing prostitution.
Right.
It was as if, man, two have died and yet it's still going on.
Right.
What will it take?
It was as if the killer wrote it. Like, that's, yeah, essentially. And so, you know, and I guess one could say, yeah, that was fact. There was a neighbor that cared.
Yeah.
But two people also died. And I think it can be said that there's a more important aspect of the story to take.
Yeah.
And you could break down, you know, more of what losing your reproductive rights mean.
Exactly. Yeah.
Someone tweeted about this. So they're saying you'll still die, but you just won't really die.
Exactly.
Okay,
or,
all right.
Well, we only have one more minute. I want to read one section from it because, okay, look, I try to be fair by saying it's not 100% wrong that we won't be going back all the way to 1973, but that does not mean that this will be the end of it. And that's where we get into a bit of naivete in this article. So there's a paragraph that says, women now have far more methods to avoid unwanted pregnancies, as well as safer, easier options for abortion. Many abortions are induced at home with a two-drug combination, and advocacy groups are spreading the word about home abortions using one of the drugs that can be done without a medical professional's involvement. All of that is true. All of that is also completely beside the point, because when they outlaw abortion, they're not gonna be like, oh, turns out lots of women are doing it at home. What can we do?
Right.
What do you think, that they're just going to relax? This has been a half century long campaign to overturn it. The next bill will outlaw this. They will track down these women. They already, by the way, in some of the bills, they already can. That those sorts of at-home abortions would already be outlawed. And so this attempt to, I don't know, reassure women that it won't be the end of the world while also sort of easing the way for the passage of more of these laws completely misses the overall strategy that the anti-abortion forces are currently using, and underestimating the passion with which they will continue this war even after Roe v. Wade is formally overturned. That will not be the end of it, it is just the beginning. And again, the media is like going out of their way to not get the magnitude of the problem that we face politically. Across, you know, the AP, Washington Post, New York Times, they do some good reporting sometimes, but they seem to be doing it in the midst of an atmosphere where they don't really get what it is that's going on in this country. Okay, we do have to take a short break. When we come back, we're gonna be joined by State Senator Kevin Thomas of New York to talk about a social media privacy bill after this.
Frozen. We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We're joined now in the Damage Report by New York State Senator for the 6th District, Kevin Thomas. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here, and I'm excited to learn more about your Privacy Act. Can you tell us what it's all about?
Of course. So for the past decade or so, we have a lot of our data, our personal information out there on the internet, where data brokers and all these other online companies are just harvesting our data, sharing it, selling it. And the average user has no control over how this data is being shared, to who it's being shared to. And that's why I introduced the New York Privacy Act, which basically allows for the user to have control over how they share their data and to who they share their data. In addition, this Privacy Act goes further than any other law right now by creating something called a data fiduciary, whereby the company that has your data now has a duty of loyalty to the user over their profit-making scheme.
Senator Thomas, good morning. Why is this something you personally, you were pushed by, interested in?
Number one, I am the chair of the Consumer Protection Committee here in New York State Senate. And I am basically responsible for 20 million people here in New York in terms of protecting their consumer rights. And privacy is top on my list of things that I need to make sure I dive into and protect while I have the chairmanship.
So I guess I'm curious. I mean, people might have an idea if they've, you know, been paying attention that their some of their data might be being accessed by companies. But how deep does it go? What sort of personal information are we talking about that's being harvested by these companies?
Well, it's anywhere from, you know, your name, your age, your occupation, to your likes. All of this goes into an algorithm of sorts that is deeply protected by all these companies. And then they target you very specifically based off of your likes and your gender and your age. And that's the kind of information that we want to protect. That's why, you know, my bill has an opt-in, opt-out scenario. So, you know, right now, products like Google and Facebook and Amazon, they have so much information. That's why they're able to basically give you those free services and give you specific, narrowly tailored advertisements. And all this information is out there. Is it being deleted? Is it there forever? Is that information correct? This is what my Privacy Act is trying to do.
And there are certainly some bills where I can imagine pretty clear party distinctions on where representatives will come down on this. But when it comes to something like data privacy, how likely is this that this will end up passing? Is this something that has a lot of support on both sides?
Right now, we are trying to get the support. I introduced this bill just a couple of weeks ago. We are going to have a hearing on privacy on June 4th, where I'm going to hear from a lot of data companies and advocates about how to move forward with this bill. This bill has been in the works for close to 5 months now. We've been sitting down with Facebook and Amazon and Google to basically go through how they collect data and how we can try to balance their profit-making scheme to protecting someone's privacy.
We talked, I believe it was last week, about congressional testimony that got into some of these areas about how much data was being collected, including things like facial recognition. And so I just want to say it's good to see that on multiple levels of the government, people are taking this sort of challenge seriously. And so State Senator Kevin Thomas, thank you for joining us and good luck with the bill.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Donald Trump, North Korean missile tests, and Joe Biden. We'll break it down after this. Okay, so that's a little bit of the domestic politics. Why don't we turn now to some foreign policy?
So much happened over the weekend.
Exactly. Okay, so over the weekend, North Korea conducted more missile tests. That by itself is its own problem. But America also has its own problem, and that is Donald Trump is our president. So he somehow turned this issue that he has with advancing his diplomatic approach to North Korea into an attack on a Democratic candidate for the presidency. So after those attacks, Donald Trump tweeted this: North Korea fired off some small weapons, which disturbed some of my people and others, but not me. I have confidence that Chairman Kim will keep his promise to me, and also smiled when he called Swamp Man Joe Biden a low IQ individual and worse. Perhaps that's sending me a signal.
I don't even know.
That's just the worst tweet in every way. He disturbs me and some of my people, yeah, I think. So look, substantively, which we'll return to a little bit later on, the idea is that he believes that he is able to have this sort of personal connection with Kim Jong-un, and that that by itself will avert some sort of hostilities between our two countries, which at least on principle I support. But that does not seem to be the sort of situation that the North Korean regime is actually abiding by. They are continuing tests, including with weapons that are banned under the current terms of their agreement. And I suppose to distract from that, Donald Trump has turned this into a thing about Joe Biden. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it is still, I believe, unprecedented that one of two things has happened. One, that a president has gone abroad and while abroad has attacked his domestic political opponents. And two, that he has sided with a murderous dictator to do that. So the particular comments that North Korea had said recently were, their state-run media recently referred to Biden as an imbecile, a thoughtless guy, and a fool of low IQ after the candidate criticized Kim in a campaign speech. And asked about that, Donald Trump said, well, Kim Jong-un made a statement that Joe Biden is a low IQ individual. He probably is based on his record. I think I agree with him on that. Now, I feel the need to remind people of this because Donald Trump does not appear to know it, but Kim Jong-un has killed countless people, both individually by killing them with dogs or by firing mortars at them, conducting insanely cruel executions of that sort, as well as just mass killings of his political opponents through starvation and work camps and all of that. Exactly, family members as well. I believe there was an uncle that might have been the mortar, if I remember correctly. And so he is siding with that person to attack one of the potential opponents that he might have in the 2020 election.
Right, and that's what my biggest issue with this is, that I refuse to play any part in normalizing the monster that is this man, the leader of North Korea. Mm-hmm. He's a monster. The human rights violations in his country, it's unheard of. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that there aren't violations in every single other country. This is just not a normal man. Yeah. This is not a normal dictator. This is, he's a horrible person. He treats his people horribly. And the president is just chumming up with him. And it's not just an excuse to have good relationship like with our country, because basically you don't want a good relationship with him. You just want this man to not try to bomb you, because we don't really know what he has going on over there.
Exactly.
And this is the only reason he's doing any of this is because he likes what this man said about one of his top competitors.
Yeah, he either likes that or, I mean, look, I would say extending more goodwill to him than he deserves. It would be an achievement if we were to get North Korea to denuclearize and to start to have a closer earned connection with other countries, including South Korea.
Yeah, but after all of that,
wishing doesn't make it so.
Right. After all of that, they came together and Kim Jong-un was like, nah.
Yeah. Well, and these continuing tests appears to be striking a far more provocative stance with Donald Trump that Donald Trump is willing to acknowledge. Look, I don't like the other side of this with John Bolton attempting to inspire hostilities against North Korea. That has been happening over the past few days too. But while we can push for a diplomatic solution to these problems, I also, as you say, I don't want to normalize any of these regimes, whether it's potentially a closer military connection with North Korea. We found out over the past couple of days that Donald Trump is going to break effectively the law in further weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. I mean, we've been continually hammering home that these are dangerous people and dangerous regimes, not to inspire some sort of military action against them, but to make sure that they're not normalized and become more common around the world. Whether it's because Donald Trump believes that they'll be easier to work with, or because the military-industrial complex in the US believes that they can make millions or billions of dollars in selling weapons to them. Neither of those is an acceptable outcome, especially when countless hundreds of thousands or millions of people are living in abject terror in those places. And so the Biden thing, look, I'm not a fan of Biden, I'm not a supporter of Biden. In doing this, my goal is not to defend Biden or his IQ. I don't know what his IQ is, I don't really care what his IQ is.
Right, exactly.
But I'm not interested in this new territory that we are moving into. And we're gonna have more sort of related to this on one particular topic with Emma Vigeland later on the show. But this is bizarre and in a particularly dangerous way, I believe.
And you know what, just thought about that when we're talking about how we don't care what his IQ is. Just that the president of the United States using that as an insult against another politician is not the worst thing about this. It's not the craziest thing about this. We have gotten to that point. That's wild.
Yeah, it is wild. And that too is being normalized.
Just, you don't expect any decorum from our president anymore. I don't know.
Well, we do have to take a break. When we come back, Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland will be joining us. We'll be breaking down more news of the day after this.
Because you're not That's putting that down. Yes, it is.
I'm picking up trash.
Put it down.
That is Naropa University college student. You're looking at him right now, Zaid Atkinson. He's talking to Boulder police officer John Smiley. Now, John Smiley is a 14-year vet of the department. And, you know, we have a lot to tell you about this incident here. We were watching this video this morning, and it is a video of a situation that happened a while ago, but it just recently, this video went viral across the nation. Mm-hmm. And so let's just tell you how this all started out, because if you're, you know, coming in listening to that, it's pretty shocking. The entire video is shocking. We watched it before the show. It starts when Officer Smiley approaches the student at what turns out to be his home and asks him essentially if he belongs there. He's saying that he notices a no trespassing sign and wants to make sure that this man, a black man, this student, belongs there. Take a look.
There's signs for no trespassing, private property, here. That kind of thing. Yeah, I wasn't sure what you're doing, if you lived here or you worked here. Yeah, it looks like you're working, doing something, picking stuff up. Okay, gotcha. What's the actual address then?
3333 Arapahoe.
Okay, what unit are you in?
I don't think I have to actually tell you that.
Well, I'm just checking to make sure that you have a right to be here, that's all.
I just told you I lived here.
Okay.
And I told you that I'm working as well.
Okay.
Shouldn't that be enough for you?
Well, I got to verify it just so I know that you do in fact live here.
All right, so as part of that verification process, student, you know, he recites his address. John, you saw that. He recites his address. He later hands the officer his student ID. He then offers to go and buzz himself into his home, which, you know, should be proof enough for anybody. But
it's a common con man tactic.
Right. Hey, I have a key. Mm-hmm. Right. A common con man tactic is to have a key. But I want to go back to just show you a little bit more of what we started off with, because you'll be able to see that this got scary for this student. As after he offers all of these things to the officer, and the officer, that's not enough, it's not enough verification, he chooses to continue to pick up trash on his property and move away from this conversation with the officer. So the officer pulls out a taser and then a gun.
You have a dangerous object in your hand and you're failing to put it down.
I'm picking up trash.
Put it down.
You're
being detained. Because you're not putting that down. Yes, it is.
I'm picking up trash.
Put it down. If you use that weapon against me, then yes, that is a consideration. All you have to do is comply right now.
I don't have a weapon.
That's a weapon.
This is a bucket.
No, that's a weapon.
This is a clamper for picking up garbage, sir.
Put it down. I'm telling you, I'm threatened by it.
It's not a weapon. You're not threatened. I'm threatened. You have a gun that kills people. How am I supposed to kill someone with
this? Sit down, sir.
As you can imagine, I mean, he's upset.
Yeah, I mean, he lives there.
And terrified, yeah.
If you were to choose a weapon that you were going to go up against a cop with a gun with, when would bucket enter into it?
Right, never. Or trash
plant. So the thing is, like, look, we're joking, but the cop clearly, like, it seems like the cop hasn't received any training because he's acting like an insane person. Right. But he clearly has been trained because he knows enough to say, I feel like my life is threatened.
Right, those
because they know that if you say that, it doesn't matter what you do. It's okay. You believe that your life was threatened. So they've been trained enough to know what they're supposed to yell to justify potentially killing that person. Thankfully, he wasn't shot. But it feels like a lot of the times that video ends with him being shot.
Absolutely. And just to wrap up just the story and what happened to this officer, this officer was investigated. And before the disciplinary action could conclude, the officer chose to quit. And from Boulder City Attorney, I want you to see this quote. It says, the exchange between Officer Smiley and Mr. Atkinson does not represent the professionalism of the Boulder Police Department nor the community Boulder desires to be. While we have no proof that racial bias was a motivating factor, the internal affairs investigation resulted in sustained violations of police policy. So fine, they're not copping to the fact that he walked upon a black man, probably because he was black, to say, hey, do you belong in this nice apartment? Mm-hmm. They're not copping to that, but they are saying he violated our procedure. And what the Boulder Daily Camera, it's a newspaper there, were able to find out that police say, had this investigation been able to conclude, that he would have been suspended or fired. So he chose to quit instead. And what that means is he will resign from the police department, but will remain under city employment until February 2020 as he exhausts accrued holiday, sick, and administrative leave. And the route, that paper there, they were able to find out that comes up to about $69,000 in taxpayer money.
That will continue to go to him, even though he will not be working.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Look, they can say that, and he'll end up becoming a cop somewhere else. They can say that it has nothing to do with race. I've never been stopped like that.
Right.
While picking up trash.
In front of your
whatever.
House.
Just walk around wherever I want.
Right.
Like there are cavemen who still believe that white privilege doesn't exist and refuse to understand what it actually means. It means that when you're picking up trash, people leave you alone.
Right, that's a good
example. Basically
right,
what it
exactly,
means.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, he was not killed in this instance, but this is just another, just touching base with, once again, around the country, this is happening every day. Right now, someone is having an experience like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take one last break. When we come back, we're going to try to reconnect once again with Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland after this. Thanks to the wonders and unerring reliability of modern technology, we are now joined by Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. It was a slog, and I'm in an office space with multiple people, so you're going to have to see how quiet they are.
Okay, well, you know, fingers crossed, but we're always glad to have you here. A few different stories we want to talk to you about. First of all, we've been talking about the failings of the media throughout the show today, and one story that I wanted to ask you about was the New York Times did an article, the entirety of which was just going through all of the insults Donald Trump has used against Democratic primary contenders, including when he used it, listing them all per person. What did you think about this use of the New York Times' resources?
Oh, well, the New York Times has really been on a roll recently, as has the Washington Post, with just producing fluff pieces for particularly no reason. The George Papadopoulos story was something that just shook me to the core of my being, trying to display him as this kale smoothie drinking California high flying individual. So I didn't think that was the best use of journalistic resources. But again, like, the New York Times does some good journalism and some phenomenal journalism. It's just a part. It kind of goes to show that even the most esteemed media sources are not inundated from and are still subject to all of these media criticisms that we have about superficiality, about focus on personality over substance, and not being watchdogs, just kind of being TMZ DC.
So I'm curious, do you think there should be some sort of a heavier responsibility? It essentially was furthering Trump's abuse, this specific piece kind of like pointing out his insults. If we have decided that in that context, his usage of Pocahontas is a racial slur, why put it on the front page and point out again that he keeps saying it, just separate from any specific news story? Just, hey, just want to like further hurt your feelings, Elizabeth Warren. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that it just plays into Trump's strengths, which is to label people the way he wants to. And so the fact that the Times is going to further those labels is disheartening. And also, they should take a look in the mirror about that. I don't think that was their intention. They've been a media source that has been critical of Donald Trump, as has much of the media. They've woken up to the dangers of Donald Trump and have decided to be more watchdogs than they had been during the Obama administration, when in many ways it was more needed. I mean, obviously, Obama was an infinitely better president, but because he was so charismatic and smart, a lot of the things that he did that I think were harmful were swept under the rug. But the media has decided to pay attention, but sometimes they pay attention in the wrong ways. And calling more attention to his insidious nicknames and racist ones towards Elizabeth Warren, for example, is not the way to go about it.
And it also, I guess it is one article in one outlet, but it worries me that going into this election, like, is this the sort of carefree you know, approach that they're gonna take to how Donald Trump campaigns. Like, they already gave him so much free coverage and publicity in the last go around. Now he has the bully pulpit, he's the president. And so I feel like literally anything that he wants to make this election about, this worries me that they will help him to do that. But I wanna turn to another aspect of media, this time right-wing media. Ben Shapiro was in the news over the weekend when it turned out that a couple who had vandalized a synagogue in Indiana last year, the man in the couple says that he blames the wife, who had become radicalized through what is becoming a fairly typical sort of map of sources of news, going from Fox News to Ben Shapiro, then to Breitbart, and then to sites like Stormfront and other explicitly white supremacist news outlets. He says it's unfair to list him amongst that because he himself is Jewish and because he is a critic of the alt-right. And yet this is not the first time that someone who has conducted themselves in this way says that Ben Shapiro is one of the people that they or their associates have been radicalized through. What do you think about that?
Well, my first reaction to this story was that Ben Shapiro is consistently claiming to see anti-Semitism in corners of politics where it's non-existent. And yet at the same time, he's inspiring anti-Semites around the United States. So the supreme irony of that is not lost on me, and it shouldn't be lost on the rest of us. He was screaming and crying about Ilhan Omar and her comments that were taken out of context. And then you have Ben Shapiro fans that are painting swastikas on synagogues. So I think that's a little bit more anti-Semitic than Ilhan Omar comments that were maybe not worded in the exact perfect way that Ben Shapiro would want. But it goes to show what this whole conversation is really about. It's Islamophobia disguised as caring about bigotry, when in fact the whole argument is rooted in bigotry in itself. So the fact that there's special attention being paid to Ilhan Omar is a bigoted kind of premise, and the fact that things like this go kind of swept under the rug when people are actually inspired to do anti-Semitic acts by Ben Shapiro goes to show the hypocrisy in the conversation.
Yeah, and like I said, this is not the first person that has either followed Ben Shapiro on Twitter and liked a bunch of their posts or anything like that. What's really interesting is I talked about sort of this familiar map of moving from Fox News to ever more extreme outlets. And I saw a journalist on Twitter was doing mapping of this through Facebook likes, because apparently your likes on Facebook are actually
chronological.
Chronological. You can see when people liked certain things, and they found examples where they moved from mainstream to more and more extreme sources. The complicating factor is that, of course, he doesn't believe that what he is doing is radicalizing people. And I wonder, like, let's say, Emma, you take off, you've got your own podcast, you're huge and influential, and then someone does something terrible and says that you're a source. I wonder, like, what would you take away from that experience? Like, would your approach be the same as Ben Shapiro's?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think we all learn lessons in this industry, and the difference between the left and the right in terms of media and pundits is that the right is obsessed with doubling down, as is our president, and the left attempts to be self-reflective. And that's in many ways why the left isn't as strong. It's just kind of by our very nature is the fact that we're more thoughtful and we're more willing to consider alternative realities than just kind of digging our heels in and saying, no, we're right all the time. So it allows for people like Ben Shapiro to appear strong. It's Trump's playbook 101. And someone like Bill O'Reilly was very good at just doubling down, never apologizing. And so I would assume, and I would hope that I would be reflective if I inspired some sort of violence, but that's not the route that Shapiro has decided to take. He's just decided to talk really, really fast and get out of it because that makes him very intellectual, John. I don't know if you know that.
That's literally the only thing that makes one an intellectual, actually. That's why I talk as fast as I do.
The rapidity of the speech. Da, 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 da.
Exactly. You didn't even say words there, but it sounded pretty smart. Imagine if you had a
British accent. I know. My IQ is 4,000.
Exactly. And I just want to make clear, while I was like, I wanted you to sort of play along with what it would be like if it were you. The difference with these personalities is that the same arguments that they make about demographic change and invasions and caravans being funded by Jewish billionaires show up in the manifestos of literal terrorists. And yet they still think that you can't really connect me to them. I don't know how clear the connection would have to be. I guess they would have to be suited up in body armor alongside the terrorist to feel any reasonable connection there. But yeah, I think that the media should be willing to acknowledge that. I want to turn to another big story from the weekend. Over the weekend, Donald Trump was attacking Joe Biden on his support for the crime bill in the 90s, saying anyone associated with the 1994 crime bill will not have a chance of being elected. In particular, African Americans will not be able to vote for you. I, on the other hand, was responsible for capital criminal, capital justice, capital reform, which had tremendous support and helped fix the bad 1994 bill. Super predator was the term associated with the 1994 crime bill that sleepy Joe Biden was so heavily involved in passing. That was a dark period in American history, all capitalized. But has sleepy Joe apologized? No. So his strategy is he's going to run to the left of Joe Biden on criminal justice reform and possibly race. What do you think about that strategy?
Well, this, I have so many mixed feelings about it. One, the fact that Joe Biden is the front runner and that he's has so many terrible policy positions in his past, including his doubling down of the 1994 crime bill, has allowed for attacks like this to happen and for Donald Trump to pretend like he's actually good on crime and criminal justice reform, especially when there's been these high profile cases with Alice Marie Johnson and Kim Kardashian and all of these things. He actually can make some sort of claim. I mean, it's ridiculous because he was responsible for the Central Park Five in many ways and has doubled down and said that no DNA testing has exonerated them, but I still believe they're guilty, which is absolutely nuts. So to claim that he has had any positive effect on criminal justice reform, especially in regards to race, is absolutely ludicrous. But I will say that Joe Biden's record on crime, on drug crime in particular, on mass incarceration is so pathetic and terrible that Donald Trump does have an argument against him. And it's going to present a huge problem, I think, for Joe Biden going forward as his record is parsed out. Because yes, he's held on to this lead of around one third of Democratic primary voters for right now. But once he stands on that stage and has to defend that terrible record, and I mean terrible with a capital T, it's worse than Hillary Clinton's. And we were very critical of Hillary Clinton from the left, at least I was. I know you were too, John. In 2016. Yes, I didn't want to speak for you. But his record is so bad that I really think it's going to be a big problem. And we're just seeing the beginnings of this with this ridiculous tweet.
Brooke, I was curious about your thoughts about the strategy.
I don't think Trump has an argument as far as like, because I just can't imagine the two of them trying to swim out of a pool on who's been less anti-black and as a black woman. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not gonna like, neither of you have been good, so I don't care. I don't think this person who has been horrifically anti-black and racist, he wouldn't even allow black people to move into his apartments.
But the thing that Trump's
done, sort of argument, huh?
The thing that Trump's done, though, effectively in 2016, he said, I agree with Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton is bought by Goldman Sachs, and I'm not. I'm self-funded. He's actually surprisingly effective at co-opting these leftist arguments as just like, it doesn't need to matter if it's completely hypocritical, but just as attacks on his opponents, just in an effort to smear them, or not even smear them, but hurt them politically in any way possible. That's just my counterpoint to that.
Completely. Absolutely. There is some young person who he has decided to somewhat listen to.
Yeah.
I'm giving Kim Kardashian credit for Alice Marie Johnson. And I would vote for her over Trump.
And Kendall and whichever the others are. I'll look up more Kardashians and then I'll vote for them. Right. Ranked choice voting with them above him. Emma, as always, thank you for joining us. Always appreciate you. And everybody can take a look at your work at Rebel HQ.
Thanks so much, John. And Brooke.
Thanks, Emma.
She's so nice.
She is.
Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Before we close out the show, though, I did want to read one of the reviews. You guys have been so great to be posting 5-star reviews on iTunes and reviews to help us get the word out. Here's a message from Dandy Guy in Space who says, John is an excellent host and really distills the news of the day in his short monologues. Helpfully, he and his fellow hosts, capital L-O-V-E Brooke, flesh out issues with great interviews that bring me a lot of new information. TYT Investigates works very well with the show, and I hope they continue to bring objectivity and progressive policies to the forefront of the news cycle. Dandy Guy in Space, I love you.
No, I love you.
Thank you, as always, for joining us. Thank you for watching, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.